Hi everyone, my name is Lu Xi. I'm from UCLA Health Forecasting. Health Forecasting is a project we've been developing to forecast future health trends in the population. And so we simulate the population growth, population grant, population trends with demographic inputs. And then we plug in the health behavior variables to calibrate the currently observed health behaviors in the population. And then we put in interventions to see what is the long-term outcome of those health interventions at this time point. So this is one application of our health forecasting tool. We are funded by Robert Johnson Foundation to tackle the issue of long-term health intervention in the state of Arkansas. Arkansas has the country's highest stroke prevalence, and it has there's a stroke belt in the American map going from the West Virginia all the way through the South. And Arkansas is called the buckle of the stroke belt. And there are a lot of reasons behind this buckle stroke belt phenomenon. There is southern diet going on, there's obesity going on, physical inactivity, and the relatively higher than average smoking prevalence in that state is also part of it. So we know that quitline, a hotline, tobacco smoking cessation aid program that has been proven to be helpful in helping smokers quit. So it's a combination of psychological counseling and the pharmacological assistance that has been shown to, like in the state of Arkansas, increase the odds of successful quitting by 7.5 times. As compared to those smokers who do not use the quitline service. But as it's true of many other public health interventions in this country, quitline program is all facing the issue of budget cut. So we had the mission of simulate the impact of downsizing versus increasing the quitline service in the state of Arkansas. So as we can tell now, this presentation is slightly different from the previous three. So the other lectures we have had in this session is about the estimation. This is more about the calibration and forecasting. So our tool is so-called, belongs to the category of micro simulation. So it's a life course model. It simulates individual life histories and the natural histories of chronic disease is simulated within each individual, and we sum up the aggregate outcomes of these individual life histories and report the future prevalence of certain disease and future trend in life expectancy in a certain population that we specify. And the micro-simulation model, in this case, differs from those more aggregate models like system dynamics in that it captures the distribution of the disease prevalence in the population. For example, the most of the aggregate models will tell you what is the future average physical activity level in the population. It talks less about the variance and how this physical activity level is distributed in a different population subsegments, and the distribution to model the distribution of the physical activity within the future populations. That is the strength of this micro simulation. The other advantage is the life course issue. So in this model, it's easier to model the early life influence, early life health behaviors, their impact on future health outcome later in this particular person's life. Okay. So we have simulated the California state population, Arkansas state population, in the county level, the Milwaukee County, Los Angeles County, and we have done the national model as well. So I'll spend a little time, more time on this specific component of smoking. So we model many different health behaviors in the, for individual. So to model the smoking behavior, we put in two stochastic events in it. The first is the initiation event. So we know from the literature that the initiation of smoking, initiation of regular smoking behavior only usually happens between 17 and age 26. After age 26, there is almost no initiation of regular smoking. There might be a few extreme cases, like maybe in the military setting or in the war combat setting, but after 26, usually there no one will initiate the smoking behavior. So individuals between within that age range will be assigned a probability of smoking, smoking initiation, according to their gender and race ethnicity, and these probabilities are calculated based on the publicly available health survey data. And the other random event I put into this individual life history is the cessation event. So about individuals about age 17 are assigned a probability of quitting based upon the gender, race, ethnicity, and whether or not this person is exposed to a quitline intervention. Okay. So these quitting probabilities are also estimated from the health survey data, specific to the gender and race, ethnicity. And by the way, by quitting, I mean the successful quit. So I assume, I do not model the relapse event. So some more complex smoking models will model the relapse. And here we only model the more important behavior of successful quitting. So the disease component as a function of this smoking component is we have lung cancer, coronary heart disease, and stroke, the three major disease outcomes from the smoking behavior. And as well as this overall, the mortality, this also be influenced by the smoking behavior. And for the health outcome, we here use a health outcome called a disease-free life year. So a life year without these chronic diseases is recorded by our model as a disease-free life year, which is often used to, for similar purposes like the quality adjusted life year or disability adjusted life year, this one is like a little bit more of a objective and measure of the life year health outcome. So we first have the birth counts of the Arkansas and the mortality data from the Arkansas state. We first simulate the Arkansas state population's growth pattern. So and then we calibrate the smoking event according to the observed smoking prevalence trend in the state of Arkansas. And then according to the documented the quitline report from the state of Arkansas, the quitline users are 7.5 times as likely to non-users to quit tobacco smoking successfully. And this is, I'll say, this is a weak spot of our modeling because this is from program report. This is not adjusted for many things, and this might be an overestimate. It could be because I'm not drawing this estimate from those peer-reviewed literature. So there are four hypothetical scenarios for our quitline simulation. So the first one, unfortunately, the first one is the most likely one, and we'll use that as baseline. We know that quitline at this point covers 4% of the smoking population within the state of Arkansas. given the bad news in the budgetary fund, we know it's likely to decrease to 2% from the current level of 4%, and then remain at 2%. The other reason why we assume this is most likely is that once the quitline, after the quitline has started, like about 10 years ago, those smokers who want to quit the most have already used a quitline. So we are assuming that there might be a kind of something like a ceiling effect going on, and then the remaining pool of smokers might be less willing to use quitline than the predecessors. Okay. So second one is more optimistic. The healthcare reform, the Affordable Care Act, has talked something about those state programs like quitline, saying that some of the federal money will be used to finance state programs like quitline. So second one, you can call it like the health reform scenario, and suppose it's not like repealed. So the third one is more optimistic, is that's the goal. CDC specified that the quitline in each state covers 6% of the state smoking population. And fourth is like the dream scenario. That's like 8% coverage is the national champion level in the state of Vermont. And suppose, imagine that Arkansas perform as well as the national champion of Vermont, covering 8% of the smoking population. So this is one outcome generated by our health forecasting tool. So this is like 25 years long-term scenario, and these are the prevalence trends that will happen given the four different scenarios of quitline. Okay, so you see that there are about 2% of the difference between this CDC recommended level and the baseline level of a quitline reach decrease. Okay, so 2% percentage difference of 2 percentage points in smoking prevalence is a lot. We know the tobacco intervention literature. 2% means a lot of lives being saved, a lot of money being saved. So take a look at this. So this is like the three. So compare in this graph, the model is comparing those alternative scenarios with the baseline scenarios of quitline reach down to 2. Okay, so we can see that they are if Arkansas is performing as well as Vermont in terms of a quitline reach, then by the year 2035, it will have gained 20,000 disease-free life years. So these life years are not only life years, though these are life years free of all those chronic diseases our model has calibrated. So this is not meant to be a cost-effective analysis, but it's just like at the end of this simulation, we do a little bit of a back-of-envelope cost calculation to see what is like the cost-effectiveness ratio. Okay, so we can see that usually in the documented literature, in the health outcomes research, if an insurance program or government spends $10,000 to gain one disease-free life years, that's often considered as a very cost-effective intervention. Okay. So for our scenario too, just to keep the quitline going at the current level, so the cost-effective ratio is $3,000. That buys you a disease-free life year for the state of Arkansas. And as the quitline reach goes up, we can see the cost-effectiveness ratio actually increases. It becomes better and better. So that is more because that as the quitline reach expands, it covers more young people. And So this illustrates the powerfulness of micro simulation. It gives you the kind of insights you might not otherwise thought of. You know? So it's like we pause and reflect on this. Like why will the cost effectiveness ratio improved with quicklime reach expands because the per user quicklime cost stays the same in our assumptions. So we went back and take a look at the model. It means that when the quicklime expands, it covers more young people in the pool, and an intervention at a younger age give you more the disease free life year gain than an intervention late in life. So that's why we get this improving cost effectiveness ratio. So to conclude, we know that first of all, this is only 2% points of difference at the quicklime reach, but it means a sizable long-term impact in the smoking prevalence. And just for comparison, when we look at the cost effectiveness ratios, the Pfizer recently had a new lung cancer drug and has made news headlines in a lot of the health media, saying that it's a major breakthrough. And the price tag is that if you're going to take that Pfizer drug, the monthly cost for the drug alone is close to $10,000 a month. So this is just a month. Okay, so in our case, we know that continual funding for quicklime buys you disease-free life year at only $3,000. Okay, so to the best of our knowledge, this is the first comprehensive micro-simulation model of smoking and tobacco-related diseases. There are good models about smoking behavior. There are good models about the chronic diseases. But to the best of our knowledge, this is the first model to link these, the behavior and disease together.
Okay. Thank you. So what's missing or unknown here, I think, is the point about what would happen if somebody wants to quit and the quit line wasn't available. And that's the point I think you highlighted. So did you consider doing any simulation studies or sensitivity analysis, to look at that issue?
Yeah.
What did you find? Or? You should come speak to the mic here.
We know that to make this a complete study and to submit it to a good journal, this will involve sensitivity analysis. So that's why we are still applying for additional funding for the effectiveness estimates that we have.
Okay, thanks. Another question?
I know that you said that Vermont was sort of the gold standard with the quit line, and 80% of the smoking population utilizing the quit line.
Yeah.
That still seems really low. Is it that there's not a huge number of smokers that want to quit, or is quit line a commitment that they don't want to make, or the funding just
Can I also ask on that? What is that 8% of? Is it of
8% of the smokers, current smokers? Okay. So actually, to assume that each year the there are 8% of the current pool of smokers will utilize the hotline, this hotline service or quitline. That's actually a very ambitious goal because, I mean, if the people keep using quitline, they will quit and they will no longer be the user of quitline again. That's the whole goal of quitline. Right, so that's the annual number. Right. Right. So every year you expect a certain number of successful quitters leaving the service of quitline, and there are new users of quitline joining in.
Okay, well, thank you. So we have about 5 minutes, so I think let's open up now to questions about all of the speakers. Vicky has come back with her 5-week-old baby, so she's available too. Other questions about any of the papers?
Well, one question from our team. Now, you had mentioned for looking at your misclassification probabilities that you expect there to be, say, underreporting of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are there any data available where people were able to look at, say, sort of aggregate data to get ideas of what those estimates using, for example, I'm forgetting the name of the technique, where you can get the estimates in aggregate because you give people the opportunity to think that. Flip a coin two times, you get two heads, tell the truth. If you get anything else, tell a lie. Now, you can't link those up to individual level data, but I think by doing that kind of technique, you can at least get an idea, hopefully more validly, of what the underlying probability is.
Yeah. I haven't... Should I come up?
I think you should. For the recording,
okay.
Please.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I actually haven't... to be honest, gotten that far yet. So in terms of finding other sources that could somehow give a better idea of what these error rates look like, I think that would be a great piece of information to put into the prior. But I haven't thought about it, but I'd be happy to sort of think about those suggestions. I think that would be well. I know that there are some studies that that will do sort of validation testing on a small subsample. So I'm thinking of I think in the treatment episode data set, the TEDS has urine testing on a small subsample of the people. So if you have a sample, if you're lucky enough to have that, you could use that validation sample to get a sense of the misclassification rates and then use that as a prior to make inference about the rest of the sample. Otherwise I haven't...
Because for your prior, you don't need to have a link to the individual level data.
Not necessarily. Site,
right?
Exactly. Yep. Yep.
So Ofer, do you want...
Yeah, you can stay.
Oh, thank you. Okay.
So you looked non-parametric, very large confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Semi-parametric, you cut it by a lot.
Yes.
What would happen if you make a parametric
assumption? Good question. So I've looked at, and I didn't present it here, so in some cases, you know, you get exact identification. You have to be very careful. So, for example, if you put a normal distribution in there somewhere, that's a very strong assumption. And you actually, I haven't sort of worked out all the math. I haven't proven it. But you actually, before you know it, you end up with point identification. But I haven't added that in. But I think that would be good to sort of show the whole continuum of inferences.
But in a way, that would be dishonest because you're assuming something that you really don't know is true. Right.
You're doing that all the time. It's just what type of assumptions you're making.
Right.
So
right.
You're making this formal assumption on the distribution shape. Maybe it will bring you to a smaller interval. You make it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure.
You always make assumptions.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and you know, one thing that I have looked at is, for example, if you start assuming that the misclassification is known, so you have a really good idea, so as soon as you make that prior really tight, you're starting to move to a more to an identified model, too. But I agree, as part of a sort of a full set of sensitivity, it would be good to look at a parametric model, too. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Cool.
Another question?
I have a question for the first speaker. I apologize if this is a naive question. I know that you guys looked at randomized trials.
Yep.
If I'm doing a, you know, a longitudinal study over a long period of time, and I'm assuming that a certain portion of those people are going to be lost to follow-up for various reasons, and I'm employing techniques of survival analysis to account for that, do you recommend that I also use the missing data assumptions in conjunction with that?
Yes.
Okay.
Because there are still missing data assumptions. People can drop out because they feel sick.
Right.
They are taking the drugs and therefore they don't want to come back. And there are people who just moved. And those two type of people would be very different on how you should account for.
Okay.
And there are methods that would take that into consideration and there are methods that would not. So I would suggest take those that do take that into consideration.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll stay here. This is the last question now.
Now, at least I think in terms of what Martin's done and what you do, I mean, misclassification is a kind of missing data.
Yeah.
And so, given that, you know, if you mentioned some situation where you can get gold standard data, like to look at very, you know, instead of having the noisy data and you've got to deal with misclassification, and you mentioned, you know, wanting us to plan for using certain techniques to, well, just think of planning prospectively, what are some more detailed things that you would suggest people do in the same way that, you know, in a study where we know we have variables we're going to collect with misclassification, we might try to collect validation data on a small subset and adjust our analysis accordingly. This is related to that because missing data is just maybe a kind of misclassification.
Yeah, so validation is, if you have money and you can go back to those people who did, you didn't get the information from and actually get it, brute force. That would be great because that would be able to give you the information on the assumptions that you can make. Because if those people are really similar to the people that you have in the study, then you say that probably the assumptions would not make a big difference. But if those who are not answering the questions are very different, then you need to know it in order to put that into your model.
So,
yeah, but in the design, it's also so two-stage designs when you're sending everyone the same, but then you are attacking those later on, a small portion of those who didn't answer. You get information for those. But usually people don't have the funds.
Well, we've come to noon. I want to thank all the speakers and all the audience and the organizer for, I think, a very interesting and productive discussion. Thank you.